All right, explorers, adventurers, and science superheroes, it's time for an incredible journey. Let's get into a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan, welcome to the show. This is where we journey all around the universe, the solar system, the galaxy, everything in between, and we learn about some of those science secrets that are lurking, some that haven't been discovered before. This week, we've got a bit of a theme about using the past to look at the future, or looking at the future to travel to the past. It'll all become clear. We're chatting to two legends who have made a groundbreaking telly show, Sir David Attenborough. Is looking to the future to travel into the past in the new series of Prehistoric Planet. It uses incredible CGI and tech to tell the stories of some amazing dinosaurs. Mike Gunton and Tim Walker, they've helped make the show, and they're on to tell us more.
We kick off thinking about what dinosaurs are going to be in it, what other animals are going to be in it, where we're going to film. We start writing stories based on the fossils that show us which animals were around in which locations. We design the dinosaurs and start using animation to turn those dinosaurs into real depictions of what we think they look like.
And again, looking at the past and the future, we'll travel to deep space high to learn about the history of robots on Mars.
Don't forget your homework, A History of Robots on Mars. ExoMars rover certainly isn't the first and won't be the last. Find out as much as you can and submit it online tonight. Class dismissed.
And sticking with Mars, I've got some of your questions to answer. One is about what the red planet is made of, and we'll look into your sleep and figure out what's happening when you're dreaming. It's all on the way in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's kick things off this week with your science in the news. A top UK surfer has said that her sport needs to be cleaner. Seven times British women's champion Lucy Campbell has said that even though people think surfing is cool and it's eco-friendly, it's very at one with nature, it actually uses plastic boards covered in harmful toxics and wetsuits that end up in landfill where they can't be broken down. She said that from now on she will only work with companies that are trying to help the environment and make surfboards that show it. I really love this idea of setting an example, because Lucy Campbell is a brilliant champion. She has a lot to lose. She makes a lot of money working with companies, but she's telling them that, look, if you don't clean up your act and look to the future and make our sport healthier and better for the environment, I don't mind, I'm not working with you. Brilliant stuff. Also, again with our theme of using the future to head to the past, all of that stuff, the world's most famous shipwreck has been revealed in a way never seen before. The first full-sized digital scan of the Titanic has been made using deep-sea mapping. Now, the Titanic, it sank in 1912, over 100 years ago now, when it hit an iceberg, and it was called the unsinkable ship, and then it sank, so it was a huge deal. You might have seen there's a film all about it, very famous, and it's buried, well, it's laying like 4,000 metres under the sea. And for the first time ever, you can see a real model of it online where you can swivel and zoom, and it's amazing how much it still looks like a regular ship, like it's been perfectly preserved. And finally, with your news, astronomers have seen what they think is the largest space explosion ever detected. It's 10 times brighter than any recorded exploded star before. It's been exploding and burning brightly for over 3 years. Now, some smart scientists have helped figure out that it's 8 billion light years away. That's what they think. They don't exactly know what it is, but a team of experts studying it have said that an enormous cloud of gas has been swallowed by a supermassive black hole. So two ginormous things squeezed together, which has made this burning explosion that's been going on for 3 years that we know of. It could be much longer. And it's brilliant, isn't it? How much we're still discovering about the universe around us. And we don't really know, but we're scientists, so we're always keen to find out more and ask those questions. Let's spin the A to Z of engineering now. I love this series. For the last couple of months now, we've been working through the alphabet, going from A through to Z, learning about different types of engineering, how things are made, why they exist, who came up with the ideas, to working from acoustics all the way through to zoos, I guess. We've been getting the help of Engers with this, our engineering expert. He's taught us about so many letters before. Let's have another one and spin the wheel to find out which one this week.
Hello and welcome to another Engineering Academy, where we're exploring an A to Z of everything engineering. Let's spin the wheel and see where we're engineering today. Over to Engers to spin the wheel.
It's O. And O is for oil rigs.
Thanks, Engers. We use energy every day in our homes, schools and businesses. You probably know that it comes from a number of different sources, oil and gas, to renewable sources such as wind, hydro and solar. Oil is found deep underground, and that can be anywhere, from deserts to the oceans. Now, while it can be a challenge to extract oil on land, it's even more of a challenge at sea, when the winds can blow at 60 miles per hour. To safely drill for oil at seas, massive structures called offshore oil rigs are used. One of Britain's most iconic oil fields is the Brent oil field in the North Sea, 186 kilometres northeast of the Shetland Islands. At peak production, the Brent field was producing over 800,000 barrels of oil per day and a massive 25.5 million cubic metres of gas. Amazingly, it took just 7 years from design to start drilling for oil and was all fully up and running by 1981. But what happens when an oil rig comes to the end of its life? Well, let's find out more with Engers.
Brent Delta came to the end of its working life in 2011. Brent Alpha and Bravo ended production in 2014 when the field became depleted, and Brent Charlie finally shut down in 2021. The next stage was for the platforms to be decommissioned, which means taken apart and recycled. The main part of an oil rig is called the topside, which is kept steady on top of strong legs, which reach over 140 metres down to the seabed. Three of the four rigs had concrete legs, whilst Alpha did things slightly differently. She had steel lattice legs. Once production stopped and no more oil or gas was being pumped, the first thing to be done was to clean and seal up the wells so no oil or gas could escape into the sea around the rigs. This is a process called plug and abandonment and can take a bit of time, especially with over 140 wells to be plugged. Once plugged, engineers could then move up to the topside, the main part of the structure. This could be decommissioned by dismantling it on site or by cutting it into pieces and floating them away on barges. Shell decided to remove Brent Delta in one piece. Now, whilst this method has been used before, never on a platform this big. Before anything could be lifted away, the topside had to be separated from its support structure. On those rigs with concrete bases, cuts were made from inside the bases. On Alpha, engineers had to abseil down to cut the steel lattices with blowtorches. As you can imagine, this was very dangerous work, and not for the faint-hearted. After 5 years of planning, everything was in place for the great lift. But how do you lift something that big in the North Sea? Let me introduce Pioneering Spirit, a special twin-hulled construction vessel. It looks a bit like two ships welded together side to side, but with a huge gap, the width of an oil rig, in between. It straddles the platform and, using 16 hydraulic lifting arms, can lift the topside in a matter of seconds. It's enormous. At 382 metres, it's as long as six jumbo jets and can lift 48,000 tonnes. Once lifted, Pioneering Spirit carried the platform back to the UK, where it was broken down into small pieces and recycled. Amazingly, 97% of the rig could be used again. The supporting legs were left in the sea where they stood, becoming a permanent home to sea life.
Thanks, Engers. These incredible structures were part of our energy history, and the process of putting them to bed has been historic too. If you'd like to find out more and meet the team at Shell, head over to the Fun Kids website. And that's our take on the letter O. It's been outstanding. If you'd like to check out some other types of engineering, why not check out optical, organic, operations, or operations engineering?
Engineer Academy, created with support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. If you would like to find out more about the A to Z, visit funkidslive.com/engineer.
More with Engers, our engineering expert, at the same time next week on the podcast. Right now, It's the bit where I become the expert, or I use my science detective skills to figure out the answers to your brilliant questions, all right? If you've got anything sciencey at all that you want answered, maybe something that you've heard at school recently, something a teacher told you and you're thinking, is that possibly right? Maybe something you heard in the playground, I don't know, with your mates, and you think, come on now, come on, pal, that can't possibly be correct. Let me do the digging for you. I will answer it. You just need to leave it as a voice note for me. You can be the star of the show. Send it over on the free Fun Kids app or record yourself at funkidslive.com, just like this one from Leo.
Hello, I'm Leo, and I would like to know, why do I sometimes forget my dreams?
All right, Leo. It's weird, isn't it? Because sometimes you forget your dreams, but sometimes they're so clear, so lucid and real that you can still remember them years later. What's brilliant about this is it's in that strange part of our body, our brain, where we don't fully understand what's happening. We've got a good idea, though. Dreams happen during a part of sleep called REM. That's rapid eye movement sleep. And that only happens for a very short part of each night, which is brilliant if you think about it, right? Incredible. You think you're dreaming for hours, but it could just be minutes. Now, when you're in this REM sleep, quite a lot of your body is paralysed. Again, very handy because it means you don't try and act out your dreams. Scientists think that dreams happen when your brain is figuring out what's happened through the day, making sense of everything, trying to understand why this happened or why that's going on, maybe putting some memories away, chucking them into your like brain's recycling bin. And experts think maybe that's what's happening in REM sleep. Because you're in that very specific cycle of your night, it stops your mind being able to properly memorizing it. By moving it into the long-term memory part of your brain, it kind of switches that off. So you can't always remember dreams. As I say, experts don't officially know 100%, but that's the general idea, Leo. Thank you so much. A brilliant question. We're travelling to space for our next one with Marty.
Hello, my name is Marty and I'm from Canada and I would like to know what Mars is made out of.
What is Mars made out of then, Marty? Well, Mars is dry, rocky, and it's very cold. It's the fourth rock from the sun, so one planet further out than us. It's about 5,000 miles wide. It's about half the size of the Earth. It's made of different elements and rocks. In the middle, there is a core of iron, nickel, and sulfur. Around that, you've got more iron, magnesium, aluminium, calcium, potassium, all different rocky elements. And that's why it's called the Red Planet, because there's a lot of iron in it. Now, what happens when iron hits oxygen is it makes something called iron oxide. Now, there are some amounts of oxygen on Mars, not loads, but there is some, and it's enough to make the rocks appear red. Here's what's amazing. Iron oxide, when iron meets oxygen, is another name for something we have here on Earth. If you leave your bike outside and it gets wet, what happens? It becomes rusty. That's what iron oxide is. So the same thing that makes different parts of your bike red also gives Mars its famous colour and its famous name, the Red Planet. Marty, thank you so much for your question. Some brilliant ones this week. If you would like to join in next week, if you've got something sciencey that you're desperate to get answered on the show, I'd love to hear it. I'd love to do all the science digging so you don't really have to, so you can just think about how different questions. Send it as a voice note to me on the free Fun Kids app, or you can record it with the big button we've got on the website. Get to funkidslive.com. Let's get to this week's Dangerous Dan, where we're looking at some of the most mean and incredible things in the world, some of the strange and brutal things that happens around the universe too. Today, we are carrying on discovering some of the most strange animal defense mechanisms on Earth. This week, we're headed to French Guiana. It's a place in the north of South America. Most of it is tropical rainforest, and we're looking at the Neocabritomys tarracua, known around here as the explosive termite. Termites are tiny animals that look a little bit like ants. They've normally got quite big pincer-looking teeth, which help them chomp through whatever is nearby, often wood. Now, this specific termite spends its life getting ready for an attack. When they get older, they develop these little blue crystals in their abdomen, these chemicals that are poisonous. This happens right through their life. And then when they're old enough, the elders, with a lot of the blue crystals, will move to the front of the colony when it's being attacked, and then it does something amazing. It sacrifices itself to save the rest. The blue crystals move to the termite's outside pouch, which is a bit like a rucksack, where it gets to work. The blue crystals are released, they react with the termite's kind of saliva, and it transforms into an explosive goo. As soon as a predator tries to eat the termite with the blue crystals in the gooey rucksack, it'll explode. All that goo erupts out and it paralyzes the predator with a sticky, toxic liquid. Now, sadly and incredibly, that kills the termite, the elderly ones. They sacrifice themselves with this explosive goo to save the rest of the colony, to paralyze the predator, so all the other termites can get away. It's an incredible bit of nature. It's amazing how science works. And that's why the Neocapritermes tarracua goes straight onto our Dangerous Dan list.
It's fun, kids. You're listening to Dan. We are chatting about something very exciting right now. Sir David Attenborough is back with a brand new series looking all about the incredible world around us. Well, perhaps not around us, because he's time traveling this time. It's a new series of Prehistoric Planet. I'm so happy to be joined by two people who helped make the show. Mike Gunton, Tim Walker from the BBC Natural History Unit. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Bye, Dan.
Tim, let me just start by asking, what's the time frame for making something like this? It seems like such a mind-bogglingly long and huge process. When do you have the first idea, and then what happens next before we see it on screen?
The first idea for this came from the guy sat to my right, Mike. He had the idea over 11, 12 years ago when he was making another series. It then took a long time to get all the people in the right place, to join up with Apple TV Plus and to get everything going. We started the production 4.5 years ago. We kick off thinking about what dinosaurs are going to be in it, what other animals are going to be in it, where we're going to film. We start writing stories based on the fossils that show us which animals were around in which locations. And then we think about what other characters we want to bring in. And then we start the filming process. We go and film a real-world back place. That's the beautiful scenery you see in the background. And then the real hardcore work starts when we design the dinosaurs and start using animation to turn those dinosaurs into real depictions of what we think they look like. So the whole thing, about 4.5 years, but Mike had the idea over 12 years ago.
Tim, you mentioned hard work there. And I did notice that at the start when you put some of the responsibility on Mike. Mike, you had your head in your hands at one point. So just tell us, what are some of the problems and the monumental challenges that face making a project of this sheer size? It's such a big endeavour that we see. What do you kind of stumble across, Mike?
The main thing about this is to be authentic and accurate. So to put all this time and work into this, it would be heartbreaking if we got it wrong. So you have to make commitments to what these animals are going to look like before you can bring them to life. So much work has to go into that. And so every time you make a decision about their fitness, how fast can they run? What do their beaks look like? What do their claws look like? All those decisions about the project, once you've made them, there's no going back. So that's the hardest thing of all, because what you fear is you've decided it's going to be like this, and then some scientist finds a new fossil and says, got three of ones instead of two. Luckily, that didn't happen. But also, I think it's not even that it's a challenge. One of the joys of doing it is when you do all that work, it's like creating something that it starts off just as a nebulous thing on a computer. As you go further and further through the project, this thing genuinely feels like it's coming to life. And so when you see the final project, you feel like you've been transported. You've got into a time machine. You've flown back 66 million years, opened the doors, and there you are, having a safari on planet Earth at the time of the dinosaurs. There they are. And if you get that right, and I think we have, it's such an extraordinary experience, because wouldn't we all love to be able to do that?
How do you begin collecting the research for this? I mean, we've touched on suddenly we might find another fossil which completely changes the game. But you mentioned the stories earlier, and I was thinking about the other series that Sir David Attenborough has given us, you know, Planet Earth or the Wild Isles series that was on telly recently. and we follow these creatures. And I know that the cameramen and people who work on it do it over the course of many, many years tracking these animals. But this is completely different because they're all computer generated. So how do you do the research to come up with these stories, Tim?
Well, look, it is different, but it's very similar as well, because that's the beauty of this marriage between the BBC Natural History Unit and the CGI world, is that we take the expertise of people that have been out filming animals for many, many years. They've experienced what it's like to try and capture amazing behavior of lions or bears or puffins or foxes. And we take that experience and then marry it together with the amazing animation work that the CGI artists do. And to get our stories, we start off with the fossil record. So we know quite a lot about this period in geological time. It's called the Maastrichtian. It's the last few million years of the dinosaurs' reign, round about 66 million years ago. There's a really good fossil record there that shows us the animals and the plants that were around at that time. So we can see which animals were around. We can see what kind of habitats they were living in. Then we think about the types of behavior they do. And animals do the same kind of behavior across the world. So animals that are in Australia do very, very similar things to ones that are in Africa or in America to get over the issues that they face by just having to live every day. They need to mate, they need to eat, they need to not be eaten by predators. So all of these normal daily behaviors, the same set of behaviors had to take place 66 million years ago because a dinosaur was an animal. And so it had to eat, it had to mate, it had to try not to be eaten if it was a smaller one. And so we can start to build this incredibly rich picture, all based on the fossil record, then combining the experience of the wildlife teams, the paleontologists, and the CGI experts. It just paints this really rich picture of what it must have been like 66 million years ago.
You are like Sherlock Holmes, picking all these clues from lots of different areas and then putting them all together. And the jigsaw puzzle is not quite right. You find another bit of the jigsaw puzzle, then another bit, and they click. Suddenly goes to the bridge, you go, aha, that must be the way it happened.
So wow.
I'm pretty confident, you know, when all the bits of evidence come together, you can be pretty confident that is as accurate as it's possible to be.
We spoke about the technological developments that have really helped this show happen. And Mike, we heard earlier how this has been in your mind for like 12 years. At what point, when you're making a show like this, do you start to think about the incredible technology and the future of technology that might help you bring this to life and how that might change in the future? So we've got this now, but in 10 years, we might get an even better representation of dinosaurs. When do you start to make those choices?
Well, there's no doubt, even in the last 5 years when we've been working on this project, the speed of the computing power, which of course you have to have for this, the amount of computing power to generate as creatures is utterly mind-blowing. But that has increased. Of course, technology is a big part of this, but I'm pleased to say that another big part of this is human endeavor, imagination, joining the dots in a way that at the moment only the human brain, I think, is capable of doing. So yes, of course, being able to speed up the computing power, maybe do the job quicker, but whether it'll be better, I don't know. I think there's some ingredients in this that I think isn't in the realm of computing. It's still in the realm of the human brain and the intuition and the imagination that a human brain needs to have to join these dots of all this disparate evidence that comes from so many different sources to come up with these stories and feel that they're authentic.
There was a couple of really cool bits of technology that we embraced that were developing as we were making the production as well. One of them was we started to use game technology. Loads of people have got VR headsets and virtual reality games. We did the same with our dinosaurs. So we made virtual environments that had the dinosaurs in them. And you could don a VR headset and enter that world and work out where you would be, near a T-Rex or near some of the pterosaurs, and work out where to place your cameras. So you're entering this VR version of the prehistoric planet to produce the shots that are then eventually going to turn into these photoreal depictions of the dinosaurs.
I still think the intuition still comes from that scientific... It comes from experience. It comes from physical experience. You know, one of the reasons why I think this series feels and looks the way it does, as Tim has said, We are wildlife filmmakers, so we're used to filming animals. We know when it feels right what animals are doing. And I think that's unique because I think most people who've tried to enter this world in the past perhaps haven't had that experience. You can't buy that. You only get that by doing it. You know, you have to have done this thing. David Attenborough was involved in this series, as you know, and he's been doing this for 75 years. You know, that's something that's unique.
Well, let's lastly just speak about Sir David Attenborough. He has brought us so many fantastic programs over the last 75 years, as you mentioned, opened so many people's eyes to the world around us in ways that have never been done before. And this, again, this new one is game changing. It would seem to me he only puts his name on something that has to be the best of the best. It's the seal of approval. How inspirational is that for you and for filmmakers working with someone who... It needs to be great. It needs to be fantastic. You can't let, I'll use the cliche, national treasure, but you can't let Sir David Attenborough down.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. It's exactly right. That is exactly right. The self-pressure to do your best work because you're working with the best. And so you don't want to let yourself down. You don't want to let him down. Also, he's still, you know, he's got an incredible TV brand. And yet he gives great, what we call notes, pointers about where we're, what he thinks it should be like. And that's still incredibly valuable. He's got such a wonderful sense of what makes great TV. And working with him on this project was the vital ingredient for its feel. You know, it wouldn't feel like it does without his voice on it. The authority and the pleasure you get from hearing him tell these stories.
It's the final cherry on top of the cake when he not only gives a seal of approval, but when he does his voice recording for it. It's like hearing the best storyteller read you a bedtime story about dinosaurs.
Wow. Well, if you're listening to this and you love dinosaurs, and why wouldn't you, and you want to time travel, watching this show, it's the new Prehistoric Planet. It's just doing it in a way that you would never experience before. It's all the brilliant work of Mike Gunton, Tim Walker. Thank you so much for joining us.
Right, before we head off this week, let's quickly head up to the smartest school in the solar system, to Deep Space High. Every week we've been getting a lesson with Professor Pulsar and the rest of the crew up there, learning really about Mars, about the brilliant red planet. We heard why it's red, remember iron oxide, rust, we heard about that earlier on in the show. Professor Pulsar and his classmates, mainly Sam, are quite focused on taking us onto the surface, the rocky surface, the red rocky surface of the red planet. And we've got some homework this week. We're finding out all about the robots used in exploring Mars. Turns out there have been quite a few.
Deep Space High, destination Mars.
Jump into your wormhole and travel to Deep Space High. The school is space. But hurry, because lessons are about to begin.
All right, that's the end of the lesson for today, but don't forget your homework, a history of robots on Mars. ExoMars Rover certainly isn't the first and won't be the last. Find out as much as you can and submit it online tonight. Class dismissed.
Right, let's see what I can find out. I found this website on Remarkable Robots where you can tap in a question and get an answer from an expert. So, a history of robots, eh? So, what was the first robot sent to Mars?
The first orbiter sent to Mars was Mariner 4, which flew past Mars on July 14, 1965, and took the first close-up photographs of another planet.
1965? That's over 50 years ago. So, next question. Which were the first robots to actually land on Mars?
The first landers were the Viking landers. Viking 1 landed July 20th, 1976, followed by Viking 2 on September 3rd, 1976. Both landers were accompanied by orbiters that took photos and scientific data from above the planet.
So, what robots are currently working on Mars?
Currently, Spirit and Opportunity are roving away on the Martian surface. Mars Express and Aurora's Trace Gas Orbiter are orbiting the planet. Mars Express even has the first webcam of another planet available.
But you see, I really want to know more about the ExoMars rover, which is going to land in 2020. I'm going to ask a question about that. How long will it take to build the first European Mars rover?
Work has been underway for 4 years and will continue right up until launch in 2018.
Here's a good question. Do the designers watch science fiction movies to get ideas for the robots?
Well, not in general, but a lot of people say the ExoMars rover looks a bit like Wall-E.
Well, Wall-E was a pretty cool dude if you ask me. Thanks, Remarkable Robot. I'm ready to upload my answers.
Deep Space High, Destination Mars. Support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening to the show. If you have any science questions that you want answered, make sure you send them as a voice note to me on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. We will be back with a brand new bonus subscriber episode very soon, answering loads of your questions. That's over at Fun Kids Podcast Plus. You can get involved there on Apple or at funkidslive.com. We've got so many brilliant series that you can listen to wherever you get your shows, Google, Apple, Spotify, and Fun Kids. We are a children's radio station from the UK. Listen all over the country on your DAB digital radio and at funkidslive.com.